Welcome back to the program. The inherent drama of presidential campaigns has given us a long line of great political reporting, from Theodore White, who set the bar in 1960, through Timothy Krause, Richard Ben Kramer, Joe McGinnis, and even Hunter Thompson. Today, Rolling Stone and BuzzFeed reporter Michael Hastings has picked up that mantle. In many ways, the coverage of campaigns is an inherently boring job, but some reporters make the connection between the campaign, the times, and the candidate. That's what Michael Hastings has done in his new book, Panic 2012. Hastings is a correspondent for BuzzFeed and a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. In 2011, he received the George Polk Award in journalism for his story, The Runaway General, which lifted the veil on General Stanley McChrystal. And it is my pleasure to welcome Michael Hastings here to talk about his new e-book, Panic 2012. Michael Hastings, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate it.
Delight to have you here. In many ways, covering a presidential campaign is this interesting contradiction. It is, on the one hand, inherently boring. You're fed all of this stuff by the campaign press office, and yet there is a certain inherent excitement in the process.
Oh, sure. I mean, because at the end of the day, it's the contest. You can even think American democracy is a sham and still realize that at the end of the day, the contest for the presidency is a contest for the most powerful, one of the most powerful jobs in the world. You know, billions of dollars at stake, careers are at stake, legacy is at stake. Every issue in the culture, you know, wealth, race, gender, you know, you name it, it's there, you know, and it's all wrapped into this really intense, now it's basically a 2-year, you know, a year and a half long experience, used to be shorter. As a journalist, you know, it's the white whale. You know, the presidential election is the white whale of American journalism, and you're trying to hunt it down and capture it. As you mentioned a number of incredible books in the opening, and it's funny, you know, Richard Ben Kramer, who passed away very suddenly and tragically, his daughter Ruby, who's this amazing reporter, was my research assistant on the book. And that was just a coincidence. But one of the, you know, amazing thing about that book, he started reporting that in 1986. Now, this is a book about the 1988 presidential election. He started working on it in 1986. He didn't publish it until 1992. You know, yeah, Theodore White, you know, did the 1960 book, and then it came out, a couple of years, I think a year or two later. You know, we're now you're not only trying to tell this story, but telling it so fast and so quickly, and you know, how can you do it while it's happening when there's so much going on? You almost have to look back on it.
And there is this sense now of telling it, of having to tell it in real time, because mm-hmm. of the way news travels, because of blogging, the internet, everything else. It changes the dynamic not only of the reporting, but changes the dynamic of the campaign.
Oh, for sure, and that's exactly it. Because they're trying to – because here's the thing. The campaigns do not want you to tell the real story in real time. They want you to tell this very finely manipulated version of events from their perspective while it's actually happening. I mean, to penetrate the Obama campaign, to get inside this massive organization is extremely difficult because they are so disciplined. You know, you could count on the number, you can count on one hand the number of actually serious leaks you had from the campaign over this period of time. That's in itself is an incredible feat. So, you know, you're dealing with, you know, especially in a media environment where there's just basically hostility at all times between the campaign and the journalists, except if you're, even journalists who are, like, really friendly to them, there's this sort of never-ending war that's going on, and you're trying to find out, and you're trying to dig and dig and dig, but you actually can't get the real story as it's happening, which makes for a strange dynamic. But then gives me something to write about in the months after the election, which it was a lot of fun to do.
Of course, the other part of it is, in this way, it's like a sporting event, I suppose, in that no matter how good the game plan, no matter how disciplined the players, there's always something that unexpected happens, which is where your book begins with the preparation for the first debate in Las Vegas.
Right, and it's funny, in August, remember the debate took place, I believe, October 3rd, 2012. In August, I was speaking to a high-ranking Obama official, and this person said to me, "You know what's funny? You know, this campaign's been great. We haven't had to tear up the playbook at all. Usually, at a campaign, there's some moment where we have to tear up the playbook and do something totally different. But you know, we're cruising." And then, sure enough, you have this debate in Denver, the gift to us political journalists, that's for sure. Because it all of a sudden, you know, even the great Nate Silver, who's obviously incredible, even when he predicts there's a 90% chance that Obama's going to win, that's a 10% chance he's going to lose. You know, and at no point during the campaign were people within Obama land looking at that possibility of losing, that possibility of failure, than the morning and the evening after that debate. Because if you're part of the political team that wins the re-election for the first black president, you're a hero. If you're part of the political team that loses the election for President Obama, then that's not necessarily so. That's something you're going to have to be dealing with on your resume for years, and you can ask anyone in Jimmy Carter's administration about that.
Of course, the other part of it is that because they were so disciplined, because it was this huge organization that had worked so well for so long, it was really one of the first examples of how they would react when the wheels did come off.
Yeah, and they reacted quite poorly, you know. And part of this was, you know, it was a shock, and I go into great detail in the book about this. You know, where you know, I have staffers going through the moment by moment experience of them actually watching the president kind of implode on TV, and they're horrified because they had always imagined that if Obama lost this election, it would be because of them. It would be because the volunteers and the staff let the president down. And this was the first time they said, oh, my gosh, if he loses, it could be because he's not the hero we thought he was. You know, this real moments of doubt. So they freaked out, you know, sending crazy emails, latching on to anything. Remember the big story the next day after the debate that they were pushing? Big Bird, right? This was the response. The response to Denver was initially Big Bird. Now they also came after the fact that Romney lied about all sorts of things and changed his positions. But you know, certainly you wouldn't have the president having opened a speech with Big Bird on a normal day of campaigning.
Of course, the other scenario that came out of that failure of the first debate was the confusion about whether they wanted this story reported in a positive or a negative way, because the more it was reported in a negative way, the more money came in.
Yeah. That's it. That's this idea of panic, which it's funny because, look, the Obama campaign statistically, by the polls, they were ahead the entire time. The closest it got, according to the Obama people, was 3 points, and this was following Denver. The day after the debate was the biggest fundraising day for the pro-Obama super PAC that Bill Burton ran. They raised as much money in the last 2 months of that super PAC. They raised $30 million in the last 2 months after that debate, compared to the $30 million they'd raised in the year and a half before. So panic, this fear of losing, you know, was huge for the campaign, because A, it focused everybody. It got everybody like, oh my God, we don't have this wrapped up. The toughest fundraising week for Obama supporters, for Obama fundraisers, the toughest week for fundraising from the entire campaign, or one of them, was Romney's trip to London, Romney's foreign trip. Remember that?
Right,
the Olympic debacle? Because people said, no way this guy can win. We're not going to throw our money away. And that changed right after the debate.
But there's also the sense early on, and you're reporting about Jim Messina when he becomes the campaign manager, he understood that something was different this time when he talked to the president about saying, you're not the same candidate you were 4 years ago.
Yeah, Jim Messina is one of these great political, you know, operator figures, you know, just someone who if you're writing about these guys, these as a journalist, as a writer, he's just so fascinating. I mean, he ran his first election, I believe he was in the third grade, at the, you know, Idaho elementary school, and he says, you know, man, I was, you know, running it for Carter, and man, Reagan whooped us, you know, and he's like, I'm never gonna have that happen again. And literally, I think he's only lost one election, you know, in a 30-year or 20-year career, and yeah, so he he understood. He was the deputy in 2008, and now he's the, you know, gets a job as a campaign manager. He's in Hawaii. Obama offers him the job and says, the reason I'm offering you this job is because I want to win, you know, and you're a winner. And that, you know, Messina had shepherded through Don't Ask, Don't Tell, healthcare, and a couple other of Obama's initiatives. So he says, you know, and Messina, and as you said, Messina instinctually knows, you know, Mr. President, this isn't hope and change. I mean, essentially, I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but this is the flavor of the conversation. This isn't hope and change. You know, you're president during the Great Recession now, and things are different. This is going to be the grind. This is going to be about, you know, reactivating this incredible apparatus that had brought us here in 2008. This is about recreating hope and change. This is about kind of manufacturing the Obama experience. I mean, if 2008 was this sort of organic experience, 2012 would be this very carefully manufactured election campaign.
And, of course, one of the things, and you come back to this repeatedly, and it really relates to the second part of the book where you talk about your own experiences in covering the campaign. Part of the problem was it was very difficult to define what this campaign was about.
Well, exactly. You know, I think, you know, look, the Obama slogan was forward, right? That's the best they could come up with. You know, MSNBC had Lean Forward, at least, you know. And that just, there wasn't, you know, essentially, and at the end of the day, it was about Obama. I mean, that's obvious, but that's what they had to sell at the end of the day, because they couldn't sell him on the economy, because nobody believed that. You know, they couldn't say, well, things are going great in the economy. They could sell that, you know, look, you know, you like Obama. He had actually done these things. And here's the list of promises of what he's going to do again. But that also seemed that's also a little dicey proposition, you know, more promises. But was, to me, you know, what was surprising too was this incredible grassroots organization. You hear so much about the ground game, but the fact that they actually had it and were able to deliver on it because of this love for Obama. It was one of the more incredible things was each of these events you'd go to. I've, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens where you'd see the president speak. People would be passing out, you know, passing out because they saw him. They'd go crazy, you know, trying to rip off his clothes. I mean, you know, the Secret Service are there to protect President Obama against, you know, all threats. But you know, forget, you know, the more dangerous kind. You know, if he didn't have guards around him, the crowd would tear him apart like it was, you know, Mick Jagger or Justin Bieber walking through. You know, maybe worse, because of this passion that he inspires in people.
And yet, even with that, covering the campaign was potentially inherently boring. In fact, your editor says to you, don't be boring.
Yeah, for sure, right, because, look, you have 30 journalists who are traveling, you know, maybe more, all the time, all getting the same information, basically, plus the 1,000 other Washington journalists, or however many there are, all trying to cover the same, you know, the half dozen, you know, 30 people. And so, you know, and nobody want. And look, the Obama campaign's goal is to make it boring, except when they want to make it exciting so they can raise money or get attention for whatever they're doing. So you're always kind of, you know, fighting and saying, geez, what can I write today to get someone to actually read this story? You know, and God, I mean, it is. How many stories can you get off one press briefing, you know, that anyone can see from their computer now? So I think it does pose a challenge, you know, it's kind of challenge just, you know, how do you keep kind of producing nonsense without losing your own mind and trying to keep some semblance of integrity and say, okay, I'll do some nonsense, but also try to get some real stories in here, too.
And then, of course, when stories do emerge, Benghazi being perhaps the penultimate example here, every effort is made on the part of the campaign to really keep that story back in the box.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, look, like, there's a senior Obama official, I think I put this in the book, David Plouffe, even said to reporters, I wasn't there. I had heard about it because he said it in some sort of you know, private setting, but I had been told about it later, on the campaign plane, voters don't, I'm going to paraphrase here, voters don't care about Benghazi, you know. So they, you know, he's looking at, he sees, you know, four Americans dead and this flare-up overseas, and they're thinking, well, voters don't care about it. It's not impacting the polling. You know, and then it becomes very frustrating. And I think the right didn't do themselves any favor on this. They kind of made Benghazi into this cartoonish issue, which then made it easy for it to be dismissed, when in fact it was a legitimate story, is a legitimate story. But because, as you say, you know, both sides want to kind of immediately make it into sort of partisan game, it again just sort of gets in the way of trying to find out what happened and you know, who's responsible and what can be done and why did it happen. And that just all gets warped by the political lens.
The other part of it is that it helps to be lucky. And the Obama campaign during this campaign was very lucky on a couple of occasions.
Well, look, Benghazi is another great example where, remember, you know, there's an American consulate burned to the ground, four dead. And what is the mainstream political media talking about the next 3 days? Are they talking about the four dead Americans? No, they're talking about Mitt Romney's response to Benghazi, which, if you remember,
right.
You know, he came out and started criticizing the president for apologizing for American values. You know, I go through in detail that very detailed in the book, but while Mitt Romney's, you know, campaign is crafting a press release about, you know, to attack the president on foreign policy, literally two Americans were about to be killed by mortars. I mean, they were releasing these politically charged partisan statements while the attack was still going on. I mean, it's kind of incredible, and it did them no favors because they looked like you know, look, Washington doesn't like, you know, the kind of amateur hour. It just looked like amateur hour. You know, it wasn't any moral outrage, any true moral outrage. It was just sort of like, it was not savvy. You know, I think Jay Rosen calls it the church of the savvy. It was not a savvy move, and he paid for it.
Talk a little bit about your own experience covering the campaign and almost getting thrown off the campaign plane and sort of breaking some unwritten rules and what happened along the way.
Yeah, I mean, look, I guess I have an issue with organized group of journalists. I just don't get along well. I got to try to work on that new year, 2013. This is my third election I've reported on in 2008, and this year I also was on the campaign planes and buses. I swore after 2008 I would never do it again. 2012 came around, and, you know, the opportunity came up. I said, sure, you know, to follow President Obama around for 6 months. Yeah, that's sort of like, you know, money in the bank for a journalist. I mean, just information, what you're going to learn and see. I have a, you know, love-hate relationship with it. It's so restrictive, as you said. What got me in trouble in the end, and I got a lecture from, I don't know if you ever watched Fox News, but Ed Henry.
Right.
On Fox News, sort of sat me down and gave me a lecture about journalism and this sort of thing. Then the White House spokesperson, you know, called up my boss and screamed at him, you know, campaign spokesperson. Actually, I'll be very clear there. You know, about what a, you know, bastard I am and whatnot. But this is what's crazy, and this is the funniest thing is that the stakes were so low, and the actual controversy was over the fact that I mentioned in the story that President Obama had shown up at a bar in Florida with a bunch of reporters who were hanging out, and they had this special off-the-record drink session with some other advisors, and Obama paid a surprise visit. And that's it. I didn't say anything else because, you know, you're not supposed to. If it's off the record, then it's pretty clear. Then you don't publish it. But the existence of an off-the-record meeting is always and historically and even actual guideline-wise what you're supposed to report. And I reported, oh, yeah, a month ago President Obama stopped by this bar and talked to 30 journalists, and they said, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to report that. I said, well, why? And you know, I was told, well, because it makes everybody else look bad. I said, well, that's sort of strange, right? I don't really care about that. And they said, secondly, you know, it's this you have to not only not report what was said, you have to pretend that it never happened. I swear, I am not making this up. Other journalists were telling me that I had to pretend that my meeting with President Obama with in front of 80 people at the Westin bar in Orlando never happened. And I just thought, and again, the stakes are low, but I just thought, what a strange mentality.
The stakes were low, but that really speaks to the issue that we talked about before, that so little was at stake or so little was clear in the overall coverage itself. It was hard to define what the campaign was about.
You know, it's a funny thing where I try, you're obviously, it's the most powerful position in the world, right, as we talked about. But so much of it getting there is just dealing with nonsense. It's absurdities, one after the other. And, you know, we all kind of end up taking part in it. But what was this campaign about? I mean, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I try to answer, you know, that in the book somewhat, but I also just maybe, you know, just kind of describe the aspects of the campaign that sort of interested me. Look, you have a Big Bird, you know, you have Benghazi, you have the hurricane at the end. You have the 47% video. You have Clint Eastwood in the chair. You know, I mean, you go through this stuff. You have this Denver. What did it mean? I think for Obama supporters, this campaign was just about a sigh of relief. If the emotion after 2008 was elation, the emotion after 2012, I think, was a collective sigh of relief that, okay, you know, the Obama legacy will continue.
Not to use the sports metaphor again, but in many ways, because their polling showed, and, you know, and Nate Silver's polling, that they were clearly going to win, it was really about running out the clock.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And see, this is why that happened with the first debate, because, you know, I remember having conversations with people before that debate, and they were redecorating their offices in the White House for the second term, you know. After the 47% video, White House officials and campaign officials figured, oh, this thing is wrapped up. So you know, and you see that in Obama in the first debate. He's kind of just, let's just get through this thing and get on back to my work. You see it when he famously talked to Dmitry Medvedev, the president of Russia. He said, well, after the campaign, I'll have more flexibility, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say. I mean, which is because it's perfectly true, you know, and it's obviously true, and everyone knows it's true. But, you know, the classic, you know, cliche definition of a gaffe is saying something that's true in Washington. But I think it was about running. It was this. But think about how much money we spent. If it was just about running out the clock, you know, think of the money and the time we all invested in it. This was a chance. It was a referendum on Obama. I mean, I think that's Romney in a weird way was a non-factor because he was such a horrible candidate. But you know, I think if we were going to say, it was a referendum on Obama. The answer was yes. We like him well enough. Obama good enough, as they would say in Iraq. But here you go.
Michael Hastings, the book is Panic 2012, the sublime and terrifying inside story of Obama's final campaign. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me. Hope you guys enjoyed the book. Tried to make it entertaining as possible.
Appreciate it.